Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 16. I'm Karen, and as usual, I'm joined by Kristen.
Hi, everyone.
You can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and at Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. Today, we're going to be talking about Tiger Honor by Yoon Ha Lee, since we did Dragon Pearl last week. Seems appropriate. And got a pretty good episode coming up. But first, I think we should jump into our news and updates, because we got some cool things to talk about today.
Oh, yeah.
One thing in particular I'm excited for, but we're saving that till the end. You don't get that till the end of the news section. You don't have to wait until the end of the episode, because we are generous.
So very generous.
Okay, so I guess I should start this off by saying I said the wrong thing last week, and I apologize to everyone in the universe. So last week I was
Because then Becky got a little confused too.
Yeah.
Everybody just got really confused, but we'll fix it now.
Yeah. So last week I was talking about Reclaim the Stars, which is the anthology that comes out in February that has a couple of the Rick Riordan Presents authors on there. I mistakenly read the list of Rick Riordan Presents authors from A Universe of Wishes, because this past week it went on sale. That book is already out. It's available now. And the authors that I mentioned last week for Reclaim the Stars are in Universe of Wishes. So another three Rick Riordan Presents authors. And yeah, so it went on sale, and that's the tweet I was looking at, even though I was like, oh, the sale is over. I'm not going to mention it right now. Like, we retweeted it from the Twitter account, but I wasn't going to mention it on air since the sale was over. And I went to put in the authors for Reclaim the Stars, and I was totally wrong. And I'm not sure if Becky like listened to the episode and was like, they're wrong, I should correct this, or if she just randomly like tweeted it anyway. Either way, thank you, Becky, for calling me out so kindly, because I felt really bad that I had gotten it wrong. But it's okay, because Reclaim the Stars features J.C. Cervantes, Daniel Jose Older, and Mark Ashiro. Mark Ashiro was also in Universe of Wishes. So I only got two of the three authors wrong, technically. But that one is coming out in February. Those are the authors that are going to be in it. It looks like a really cool anthology, and you guys should definitely check it out. But I just wanted to make sure that on air, I admitted to my faults so that you guys didn't think I was a lying liar who lies.
You weren't a lying liar who lies. You were a mistaken mistaker who mistakes. And it's okay. We all make mistakes. Lies are intentional. Mistakes just happen.
That's true. That's so much more gentle. Okay. What did you say? A mistaker?
Mistaken mistaker who mistakes.
Yes. I will claim that one.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, you did only really get two authors wrong.
Right.
Since Oshiro's in both. So that's kind of hilarious.
Not bad. Not bad.
But yeah. But I mean, you know, you can check out both.
Yeah, definitely check out both. There are a lot of anthologies, like we talked about before, that have a bunch of the Rick Riordan Presents authors in them. And they all sound like, if you like the Rick Riordan Presents books, they all sound like they'd be right up your alley anyway. So I think it'd be worth checking out. But that's that. That's cool. Go read them. Tell us what you think if you do. We also have another birthday. This time it was not a fictional birthday. It was a real person's birthday. Daniel Jose Older's birthday was January 18th. And all he wants is for you guys to pre-order Ballad and Dagger, which I think is a fair request.
I mean, sounds like it.
Yeah, that's totally fine. And I think you should go do that, because the book looks like it's going to be amazing. In other Rick Riordan Presents news, we haven't seen the cover, but JC Cervantes tweeted that she has seen the final cover for the Lords of Night book and absolutely loves it. So I'm assuming we're probably going to see it soon. That book publishes in September. And I'd say, like, usually sometimes covers come out like a year in advance. Sometimes it's 6 months. Sometimes it's a couple of weeks. I've seen some books do that before, but I would imagine we'll get the final cover for Lords of Night pretty soon here.
Yeah, once the author's seen it and they finalize it, mm-hmm. it's usually not too long before they... Authors love to share.
Yeah.
They really do. So they usually... I don't think they usually let the author see the final one until it's getting pretty close. So I would think, yeah, it's probably not too long before we'll get to see it.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. I'm really curious to see what it looks like, because all the covers for the Rick Riordan Presents books are really fantastic. So, you know, that's going to be a good one. Okay, so we also got a Rick Riordan blog post update on January 22nd. Now, there's no major news in this one, but I'm still going to run through all of the points anyway, because I think they're worth talking about. He says right at the top of the blog, there is no Percy Jackson television show news. So if that's all you're there for, then you can just leave now. But that's fine. We're interested in everything he has to say. So the first thing he mentions is that Arusha and the Nectar of Immortality comes out April 5th. So that's the next Rick Riordan Presents book that's coming out. It is the fifth and final book in the Arusha series by Roshni Chokshi. You can pre-order it now. And as we both know, Kristen, pre-ordering books is huge for authors, big or small. It's really important to pre-order their books. It really helps with like Amazon standings and sales, and it just kind of gives them an idea of like people's interests and stuff. So whenever you can, try to pre-order a book you're interested in.
And if an author is traditionally published, which is how all of the Rick Riordan Presents authors are, it's all traditional publishing, it can really, really, really help when the publisher's considering sequels and whatnot mm-hmm. for a series. Because I've had some traditionally published authors in the past that have really counted hard on their pre-orders to make a case for why a book deserves more, you know, more time in that universe. So, yeah, definitely. If you like Arusha, if you love that series and you want to see more from Rakshi later, whether it's Arusha or more of anything else, you definitely want to pre-order. That definitely helps.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. And I mean, please, can we get a spinoff? Can we get a second series? Can we get a whole new series? Like, literally anything she writes, I will read it. I'm here for it. So please don't let this be the end of Roshni in the Rick Riordan Presents imprint, because that will make me sad.
Yeah, Karen would be very, very sad.
Yeah. City of the Plague God by Sarwat Chadha is now out in paperback. So if you were hanging on for that paperback to come out, you can get it now. He's still working on Rise of the Chaos Goddess. So we know everything's going well on that front. But yeah, if you want the paperback, that's also available. And then so Rick does this every once in a while. I feel like he used to do it a little bit more in the past, but he's written before about like what books he's reading, and he will give us like book recommendations every once in a while. And I've always really enjoyed this because, one, I'm interested in what kind of books he's reading, considering what kind of books he writes. Like, he's probably interested in a lot of the same themes and stuff like that. So you kind of know that if you like Percy Jackson and he's reading something close to that, like, it's going to be a good book. But also, he has a wide variety of interests. So I'm always just curious, like, because they always say good writers are good readers. Like, if you want to be a writer, you should read a lot. And especially bigger authors who, I mean, his plate is very full. So I would imagine, I'm curious how much time he actually gets to read and everything. So when he does have a book recommendation, I'm like, oh, what's this? I'm very interested in it.
Yeah, for sure. I wonder if maybe he had some time over the holidays.
Yeah.
Maybe made some time over the holidays to read a little bit more. So maybe that's why he's got some recommendations right now.
Yeah, that's a good point. So Rick recommends The Marvelers by Danielle Clayton and The Door of No Return by Kwame Alexander. And both of them look pretty interesting. I think The Marvelers is a middle grade book, and it looked kind of like something the Rick Riordan Presents readers would enjoy. But also I wanted to shout out Shattered Midnight by Danielle Clayton, because that book is literally everywhere right now. I think it just came out, but it is all over my timeline, and it looks really good, sounds really good. Has nothing to do with, you know, Rick Riordan Presents other than the fact that it's also published by Disney, but it's just everywhere, and I couldn't ignore it. And I figured if Rick was recommending a different Danielle Clayton book, then we might as well recommend the other one as well. So check those out.
I know literally nothing about that book, but is it like a Cinderella telling or something?
You just had to ask me that, didn't you?
Sorry. I only asked because of the midnight thing, and then you said it was Disney, and they've been doing a lot of like fairy tale retellings lately.
Yeah.
And it made me wonder if maybe it was.
So I'm once again a mistaken mistaker who mistakes, because this actually does have something to do with Rick Riordan Presents. This is the quartet of books, each written by a different author. And one of them is an author from Rick Riordan Presents. So Shattered Midnight is The Mirror book two.
Oh yeah, this is the Mirror series.
Right.
Okay.
So let's see. The third book is Fractured Path by J.C. Cervantes. So it does have something to do with Rick Riordan Presents.
Hey, love that.
So let's see. I don't think this has anything to do with Cinderella.
No, if it's part of the Mirror series, then that's probably what the whole Shattered Midnight thing goes with. I just, out of, you know, when you said Disney and it didn't have anything to do with anything else really, and I was like, okay, like I wonder if it's like a different, you know, take on Cinderella, but no, it's probably just part of that Mirror series. And
this says innovative four book fairy tale series following one family over several generations and the curse that plagues it. So each book takes place in a different year and a different city. And I remember us talking about it and being like, oh, that sounds like a really cool concept, like especially some of the years and the places we were talking about. Yeah. So yeah, cool. I'm glad you made me look that up, because now everything's rushing back to me. Guys, there are so many books to keep track of.
Like, it's insane.
It's crazy. And that's just within this little bubble, let alone everything else we read outside of that. So thank you for being patient with us. But speaking of books, and one book in particular that we are very excited for, is we did get a slight Solangelo book update. Now, there's nothing major here, but I really like what Rick had to say about it. So I'm going to read this passage directly from his blog. It says, as for me, I'm spending my days in Tartarus, sunbathing by the river Phlegethon.
That sounded pretty good to me.
I think I did okay there. Doing regenerative yoga with the regenerating monsters, taking scenic hikes through the blistered, tortured landscape, and enjoying that fresh, poisonous air with my buddies, Nico and Will. It's such a joy to work on the manuscript Mark Ashiro has written and adding my own voice to theirs. The book won't be published until 2023, but wow, I think you're going to love it. Inviting Mark into this world has been like getting to share my Lego set with a genius friend who can show me totally new ways to build cool stuff out of the same blocks. Stay tuned for more info. I love that visual of like you sharing your Legos with somebody who gets to show you how to build different things than you're used to building. I think that's so cool and probably really exciting for him as a writer.
As someone who was introduced to the wonders of Lego Masters this year,
that's true.
I can firmly tell you that the things I used to build that I thought were amazing and imaginative from my brain do not compare with the things that these sculptors can do with bricks. It is amazing the things that they come up with and that they can, you know, sculpt out of Legos. So the whole idea of that is like, it just, it makes so much sense to me. Like he's been doing one thing with his Legos for so long. Like, you know, he knows how to do it. He loves doing it. Everyone loves watching him do it. But then someone who comes in and has a different skill set says, oh, but look what I can do. And you get this whole new crazy, fun, amazing thing. And that's really cool.
Yeah. And as somebody who's worked with a co-writer before and somebody who's just like had other writer friends that you bounce ideas off of, it's so important to surround yourself with people like that. And especially people who think differently than you do, because there'll be times when I'm writing and I'm like, yeah, this is okay, but I feel like it could be better. Or like, I'm really stuck. I don't know what to do. And I'll ask either my co-writer or a friend or somebody about that. And they'll come up with something that I didn't even think of that totally works. And I know that we think of writing as a solo adventure, and it is a lot of times, but there are a lot of people who work on these books, especially somebody as big as Rick Riordan and the Rick Riordan Presents imprint. You have editors and you have all sorts of people who kind of have their hand in publishing this stuff. And that's why it ends up being so good, is because it is a collaborative process from beginning to end, even if Rick's name is, you know, on it at the end of the day. And I think being able to see a little bit more of that collaboration is just really interesting to me as a writer, a reader, and somebody who just really loves like this fandom.
Totally agreed. Yeah. I mean, when you think about proofreaders and, you know, I know, in the past, I believe Rick has used a sensitivity reader or two, mm-hmm. and there's always the editing process, which is, you know, its own beast. And yeah, there's a lot of people that touch a book, despite it being Rick's baby, you know? So yeah, I think it's really cool to see him take on a co-writer, and to have it be a really fun, fresh, new experience for him is exciting. Even just to see him be like, okay, all right, I like this co-writing thing. Like, yeah. All right, I can do this. You know, that's, it's really cool. Cause I know there are authors who have co-written and then have been like, I don't think it's for me.
Yeah.
I'm glad Rick seems to have taken to it, because I do think there's a lot of really fun things that can be done when you've got two people who have different experiences that can something to the same story. Like, I think that the perspectives can just really help a story like become like cohesive and wonderful. So
yeah, definitely. And I can imagine working with somebody on a project like this kind of rejuvenates some creative juices and stuff like that. So I know whenever I talk to people about stuff, I always get like a little more energy to keep going and keep writing. So I hope that Rick's feeling the same way,
charging up his creative batteries.
Yes.
Charging them up.
So here's the exciting part that I wanted to talk about at the end of the news section. Disney Publishing is giving us 3 copies of Tiger Honor to give away. How cool is that?
Hard copies, right? Like,
yeah, they're physical copies.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's pretty cool. I'm excited. I'm not even winning the books and I'm excited. So now, unfortunately, this is a US only giveaway. I'm very sorry to our international listeners. I know we have some of you guys out there. Maybe in the future we'll be able to do an international giveaway, but for now, this will be US only. There will be a full breakdown of the information about the giveaway on Subjectify Media prior to this episode coming out. So it should be there now as you're listening. The giveaway will be open for 2 weeks, which means that it will close on February 7th. So that's 2 Mondays from now. And we'll have 3 lucky winners win the books. And it's all very exciting. We'll use Rafflecopter, which I've always really liked. And there are different ways to enter. So we'll probably, you know, you guys can follow Prophecy Radio. You can follow Reed Riordan. You can follow Yoon Ha Lee. And that'll get you one entry into the contest. So there's lots of ways to enter, lots of chances to win. And we'll pick three people and you'll get an email from prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com asking for your mailing address so that we can give it to Disney so that they can send the books directly to you. So don't miss that email. Make sure that it's not going to end up in your spam folder. We will remind you on next week's episode about the giveaway so that you don't forget if you hadn't entered already. And we will announce at least the first names, I think, of the winners so that you guys know that it's been done and all of that jazz, but probably give people like, I usually give them 48 hours to respond. And if they don't, then we'll move on to the next person. That way we're not waiting forever for people to get back to us with their addresses. But like I said, all that information will be in an article on Subjectify. I will make sure the show notes link to that article, but you can look at either Subjectify Twitter or Prophecy Radio Twitter, or go to subjectifymedia.com to find that information.
Sounds good.
I'm very excited. This is cool. And we might have some other cool things coming up throughout the year. So this is definitely a good time to get in on the ground floor, because this is just the beginning, but it's a good beginning because who doesn't love a book giveaway? Yeah, I'll take a free book. Like, okay.
Oh, yes. And Tiger Hunter is a good one.
Yes, it is. And speaking of, that's what we're talking about today. Tiger Honor by Yoon-Ha Lee. This is the second book in the Thousand Worlds series. It is a sequel-ish to Dragon Pearl, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. I have a full review, a full spoiler-free review on Subjectify Media if you want to go see my very detailed thoughts about it. We will be remaining mostly spoiler-free for this discussion. However, we will be talking about, sort of like we did last time, we're going to talk about the characters, and some of the characters come in later in the book, so there might be a little bit of spoiler. So if you don't want to know anything, go read the book, then come back and listen to us, but we're not going to give away like the ending, so you should be safe there if you want to listen anyway. So just to make sure we're all on the same page, here's the general plot of Tiger Honor. Sabine learns of their acceptance into the Space Forces at the same time that they learn their Uncle Juan has been branded a traitor. They must survive their first day as a cadet and decide where their loyalty lies, with family or with the Space Forces. So right off the bat, I just want to ask Kristen how you felt about Tiger Honor, especially in comparison to Dragon Pearl, and if you have a preference or just like your general thoughts on the book.
I think I liked Tiger Honor a little better.
Okay.
Not because I disliked Mean or anything like that. It was mostly because it moved a little quicker. Dragon Pearl was a little longer, and I think it took a little longer to get into the action of it. And for me, I think Tiger Honor had enough going on that I felt like the pace was a little more constant.
Okay.
So I think I might like Tiger Honor slightly better. On the other hand, the thing I liked the most about Dragon Pearl was that Mean, no matter what was going on, she always seemed to have, like, her perspective was pretty clear. Like, she still knew what her end goal was.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew where she was going, and she knew what she wanted. And she had to remind herself occasionally, but, like, you know, she was always focused on what I'm doing here has a purpose. I'm not just doing this to be mean. I'm not pretending to be their friend, you know, to toy with them. Like, I'm doing it so that I can get information about my brother and to help Zhang, you know, move on to, you know, to peace and whatever. Like, she had a distinct purpose for being on the ship all that time. And then, you know, when she did finally get down to the planet, like, slowly but sure, you know, she knew what she was doing. And I feel like in this, telling this story and having Sabine be as conflicted as they are, which I completely understand, was a little harder. Also because we know Mean and Juan.
Right.
And it complicates the matter. Like, it does. Because I already love Mean, and I know that, you know, she's not a threat. And I know that her charm is, you know, not something she's trying to use for evil's sake. Like, she's using it because she has to, usually, you know, and so I don't question it when she uses it on Sabine. And then Sabine has this extreme reaction to it. And I get it, like, in the story, I totally get it. But, like, for me, it took an extra couple of minutes to be like, okay, take a step back, think about it from a tiger's perspective, and mm-hmm. a tiger who doesn't know who she is and doesn't know, you know, all of that. So I think I like Tiger on her in general better, but there are some things that made this a slightly harder read for me than Dragon Pearl.
Yeah. Okay. That's really interesting, because I think I feel similarly, but also the opposite, because I think I like Dragon Pearl a little bit better. Not to say that I didn't enjoy Tiger Honor, because I definitely did. And this is kind of where things get a little weird or complicated, is that I don't think Sabine is an entirely likable character. I think that they are very well written, and I think they're interesting, but it's not the type of character that I gravitate toward. Mean is that kind of troublemaker, the person who goes outside the law, who maybe doesn't do does the wrong things for the right reasons. I love those kind of characters. I think they're very interesting. Sabine is, they follow the rules to the letter, to the point where they think the Space Forces are too lax about certain things. Like, are you kidding? Like, that's nuts to me. And I think that a lot of Tiger Honor is their inner monologue. And that is a little bit difficult for me, because my brain is very action oriented. I like action driven books and movies and television shows versus character driven books and movies and television shows. And I think this one was a little more character driven in the beginning. I think at the end, it really takes off. But in the beginning, a lot of it is Sabine's inner monologue. And I wasn't bored by any means, but it was very much like trying to relate to this character after having been in Mean's head. I found a little bit difficult. Not because I didn't necessarily relate to Sabine, because I'm also a rule follower. and I'm probably a lot more like Sabine than I am Mean. But it's just having been in Mean's head, especially reading them back to back, having just been in Mean's head, it was a little hard to jump into Sabine's and be like, yes, this is the person who I'm rooting for. When in reality, you're seeing Mean from their point of view, and you've already been rooting for her, and now they're at odds, and you go, oh no, what do I do? I want them both to win. And I think it's a very purposeful and very interesting way to write a pair of books that are sequels, but also are from two different characters' points of view.
I agree. Yeah, it's definitely an interesting way to write a continuance of Dragon Pearl's initial story, because I didn't necessarily assume that we would be seeing Mean in this book. Mm-hmm. Like, I knew it was a possibility, and I thought maybe we'd see her, you know, near the end or as a little cameo or something like that. But she shows up a little faster and then sticks around longer than I thought she would too. So it was definitely different from what I initially expected from Tiger Honor.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's a really interesting way to link two books together to kind of continue the story, but to tell it from a new character's perspective.
Yeah.
And have that character be linked to your antagonist from the first book.
Right.
It's a very interesting way to get people back into the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think, yeah, I think it was really smart to have the books be from two different perspectives. I think that makes it a lot more interesting and kind of fills out the world a little bit more and allows you to navigate different areas of the world that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do with just Mean, because this way we got to meet the whole Juhuan clan, the Tiger clan that Sabine belongs to, their family. And you wouldn't be able to really do that or know what was going on there unless you were reading this from Sabine's point of view. And before we get into the details of their family, I wanted to talk a little bit about Sabine's struggle with duty, because that's what most of this book is about. Pretty much all, the entire book is about Sabine going, okay, should I stay loyal to my family or should I stay loyal to the Space Forces? Because they've always wanted to be in the Space Forces because of their uncle. And this was a lifelong dream and something that they worked very hard to be able to do. But at the same time, they grew up in a family that said, family comes first. Your loyalty is to your family first, always. And Sabine had to decide for themselves what right and wrong was. And I find that fascinating, because when you're brought up to view the world a certain way, it is very easy to regurgitate what you've been taught. And Sabine doesn't really do that. Like, they do that a little bit in the beginning, but as the story moves on, you can feel that they feel more and more uncomfortable just blindly following what their uncle is saying. And the fact that they were able to step out of their family's shadow and think for themselves is something that not a lot of adults can do, let alone children. And I think it's a really interesting lesson to have the readers of this book learn.
It's especially interesting to me because before Sabine leaves home, the matriarch, I think it's the matriarch, and I think it's one of the last things that she says before Sabine leaves, something to the effect of, you know, your family comes first, or your duty to the family comes first. And then the moment they arrive on board this ship for training, one of the first things they hear is, your duty is, you know, no matter what duty you've sworn to your planets and to your families and to your species and whatever, your ultimate duty is to the Space Force. And I'm like, okay, like, yeah. I get it. Like, it's, you know, like, everybody wants your ultimate loyalty. And I knew right there and then that it was going to be something that Sabine was going to struggle with. And as anyone would, especially at age 13.
Yeah.
Being told at 13 to decide your loyalties, that's a lot. Like, that's intense, man.
Yeah.
Because you still want to be loyal to your family. You love your family. And even when they're as intense as the Zhuang family, and we'll get there, you can tell that they still have a lot of affection for their family. And so wanting to stay loyal to the family, but also wanting to do this thing, dreaming about their whole life, like, mm-hmm. that's, I can't imagine that pressure. I really yeah. can't. Like,
what was I doing at 13? I have no idea. Not this. Right?
I was putting my hair in pigtails and putting star stickers on my nails and buying Lisa Frank folders. Like,
yes.
Had to have been watching, I think I watched Titanic at age 13.
Gross.
If I'm not mistaken. Oh yeah, that's right. You heard it. But yeah, like I was definitely not thinking about anything this heavy. So mm-hmm. yeah. It's yeah. a lot.
Totally agree. So that's a really good transition, I think, into talking about the Juwan clan, because they're very intense. I did not like the matriarch, full stop. I don't think you're supposed to like her, but she is the authority for the clan. Her word is the final word, no matter what. Nobody even really thinks to speak up against her. And she's kind of controlling everything within the clan, and she has her own little stuff going on outside the clan in other places with other members of the clan sprinkled throughout, you know, the Space Forces and like all over the universe. I thought that she was interesting in that regard, and we don't really get a whole lot of what's going on behind the scenes. So I think there's a lot of room there for more information to come about if any other books were to be published in the Thousand Worlds series. But I assume you weren't like head over heels in love with the matriarch.
I'm with you. I'm pretty sure you're supposed to hate her guts.
Yeah.
Not gonna lie.
Yeah.
Now, not only is she like stern and, you know, whatever, but you can't even like speak in her presence. Mm-hmm. But I think it was Sabine who says something at one point, and they all like the whole family looks at them like in one movement, and they're all staring at them like, come on.
Yeah. The only person that I truly liked from the clan was Aunt Suni. I feel like she was the most relaxed and the one who liked Sabine the most, and like even more than their parents. Like, you don't really get a whole lot of warm fuzzies from the parents. Now, I think part of this is probably, like in our society, there are cultural differences. There are ways that families work together. There are ways that you grow up that is normal and not necessarily a bad thing. And I don't think having a strict family or one that relies on loyalty and those sort of things are necessarily bad. And as we've seen, there are very good members of the Tiger Clan, not to mention Sabine themselves. But I think a few of the members take it a little far. And honestly, most of the rest of the family just kind of sucks too.
Yeah, they don't exactly strike me as a warm people.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's a tiger thing that I don't entirely understand yet. Like, maybe that's just something that the Tiger Clan, they're not like a warm, fuzzy kind of being. I don't know. The whole family leaves something to be desired for me. You're right. Aunt Suni was definitely a little better than everybody else. But like, yeah, nobody really struck me as being particularly awesome or, you know, like, I remember learning about Mean's family. And, you know, while she wasn't super fond of her aunts or her cousins or whatever, like, I found them charming.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like, they're kind of silly. And, like, the fact that they had been hiding jades in the cabinet for years, yeah, and not told anybody. And, like, silly stuff like that. Like, it endears you to them, even if the main character doesn't love them, you or doesn't necessarily, like them. You can tell that they still love them. Like, they still have respect and affection for their family. And yeah, you get the hint that like maybe Mean isn't as fond of her aunts because they've had to discipline her or whatever in the past. But it's, you know, it's all lighthearted in a way. Whereas with the Tiger family, it's a lot more serious all the time. And I would never survive in that. Yeah.
Me neither, for sure. And yeah, speaking of Mean as well, you know, like we said, we see her from Sabine's point of view. I think it was really interesting seeing her from an outsider's point of view because Sabine doesn't know what she's up to and doesn't trust her, especially once they find out that she's a fox spirit because of the stories that they've heard about fox spirits being tricksters and kind of always being up to something. We know she's just trying to help and do the right thing, but I thought it was really cool to see Mean from Sabine's point of view, as well as June, because I was so glad he's still around. Like, I wasn't really surprised, but it was just really nice, especially to reunite with him as well. And I'm glad that like things are going okay for the two of them now that a little bit of time has passed.
I agree. I was a little worried for June just because, you know, the whole ghost haunting you on spaceships thing we knew wasn't going to be easy. So like, it seems like this isn't, you know, isn't Mean's first, it doesn't seem like her first posting, you know, like I think Means been working for a little while in between the two books, kind of.
Yeah, not a ton of time went by, right. But I think enough of it went by because we found out in the short story that she wanted to be like an agent, and mm-hmm. now she is one. And I mean, she's yeah. still like kind of in training, and she has a superior that she's following and stuff, but she's an actual part of the crew with a job that she's completing.
Right. So, like, I feel like there has been some time, and they've found a balance. Like, they've figured out how to keep June around and how to, you know, mm-hmm. and I love that in, you know, I think it was at one point Mean in the story says, well, that's my bad luck for you.
Yeah.
Like, she's still, like, making allowances for it. Like, ugh, thanks, June.
Yeah.
You know, this is your fault, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
But I, yeah, and I just love that she goes, she's kind of accepted it. It's like, I'm just going to have some bad luck. Like, that's just my life now, because the alternative is not having her brother anymore. And that's not even an option.
Yeah. Nope.
So nope, I thought that was cool.
Yeah, I agree.
So one of my favorite things about Yoonha Lee's books are the side characters. I tend to really love the side characters. We talked about them extensively in Dragon Pearl, as well as the short story, The Initiation. We got a couple of good friends and sidekicks in Tiger Honor as well. It starts with Baek Ji, who goes by he, him, and is a human. He is a tech genius hacker. And let me tell you, half the stuff in the story wouldn't have been able to come to fruition without him.
Oh my gosh. I love this guy. Oh my gosh. G is a freaking genius. And I love G. I love G so much. That's yeah. all I got. I just love G. I just love G.
That's totally fine. You're allowed to love G. So we also get Yuna, who goes by she, her, and is a celestial. This is our introduction to celestials in the story. She is a weapons expert, and because she's a celestial, she can survive in space. That's a cool superpower to have when you're on a spaceship.
What? Yeah, right? I know, right? When Yuna said this, I was like, wait a minute. Like, hold on a second. Because, yeah, not something I would have ever considered. But it makes total sense why someone who has that ability would go into the Space Force.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a no-brainer. So yeah, that's, I love Yuna. That's a really, really cool concept for a character too.
Yeah, I agree. And lastly, out of our trio of newcomers, we have Namgyu, who goes by they, them, and is a dragon spirit. We've met dragon spirits before, and they want to be a healer / medical professional. Also a good skill to have, and one that they relied on a lot in this book.
Yes. Lots of need for medical professionals.
Mm-hmm. I really liked the way that Sabine interacted with their friends, because it was very different from Mean. I think Mean was pretending to be somebody else and genuinely liked the people around her and felt guilty for misleading them, but like ultimately everything kind of worked out. I think Sabine was a little bit slower to warm up because they are constantly nitpicking everything that they're doing and going, oh, this isn't really following protocol. This isn't really the rules. Like, should we really be doing this? I mean, gee, you know, hacking everything, not something Sabine's super cool with at first, and then realizes how awesome it is. But I think that it also, once their friendship is cemented, it's going to be there for a while, because Sabine is a little bit slower to warm up to people. And I thought it was just a really cool dichotomy to see paired against each other, having first read Mean's story and now reading Sabine's story.
I do agree with you there. It's two very different circumstances, considering Mean really couldn't be herself.
Mm-hmm.
And Sabine is trying to be themselves as much as they possibly can, and pretty quickly gets into a position where they have to make some pretty tough decisions, you know, just big life decisions almost all, yeah, you know, all at once. And so it's a very different set of circumstances to watch them interact with people that could very well become their friends. And, you know, and here I think Sabine had a slightly better shot at it, just because at least they were able to put their best foot forward most of the time.
Right. Mean had to hide a lot of herself.
And at least for introductions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no questioning that they met the real Sabine.
Right, exactly.
And so that is a foundation that you can, you know, you can work on. And even if things mess with it in the meantime, you still have that foundation to work on. So yeah, it's definitely a different kind of situation for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that actually brings up another good point, is that one of the things that I really loved about Sabine is their ability to step into that role of leader very easily. And of course, they wanted to go into some sort of command position. Like, everyone had their own tracks, whether it was like medical or weapons or whatever. Sabine wants to be in command like their uncle. And it's very easy to see how good they will be at it when they finally get to that point. Because let's remember, all of this happens on their first day on the ship. They're not even technically a cadet yet. And they have to make, like you said, life decisions about, at 13, about where their loyalty lies. This is just insane. But I never really felt like Sabine, I don't want to say not like they didn't struggle, because I think that they did, because it is a very big decision to make and they can see both sides of the story, but they took the time to think about it. And when they made the decision, they made the decision.
Yeah, I'll definitely give you that. Sabine has some incredible leadership qualities.
Mm-hmm.
It may have taken them a moment to make their decision about their loyalties. You know, they may have had some doubts and thought it through. But like, once Sabine truly chose their side, it was done.
Yeah.
I started to feel bad for the other side at that point, because Sabine was really like devoted, and once Sabine had the loyalty of the people, you know, alongside them, I was really shocked at how well the others listened and just took orders that were coming out of Sabine's mouth without any question. Just, okay, here we go. Like, it was really, really easy for them to just slip into command. So yeah, I agree. They're going to make a really great commander at some point.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about Juan a little bit, because of course we already know what happened in Dragon Pearl, and he's been branded a traitor, and he comes back to try to take over the ship and seems to have really gone off the deep end. I'm not going to lie. I had a little bit of pity and a little bit of understanding for the captain by the end of Dragon Pearl. He did some awful things. I recognize that. And I think a lot of those things are unforgivable, but never really felt like he was crazy until this book.
Yeah. Dude's got some. Yeah. It was rough, man. Okay. I will be the first one to say that in Dragon Pearl, I didn't hate him.
Right. We talked about that last week.
Like, I thought he was actually quite likable, and I thought that, you know, until about the three-quarter note in the book, like, but for about three-quarters of the book, I didn't necessarily think he was the be-all, end-all bad guy. I thought maybe he was kind of being set up by someone to look like the baddie, and I was going to see how it went from there. But no, you know, like, we found out what happens in the end there. Well, here, he doesn't really give you any options as to whether or not he's going to be likable in this book. Like, he's straight up chaos from the moment he shows up to the moment he leaves. And he does some really terrible things while he's there. I don't know if we want to get into it because it might be considered spoilery, but one of them involves Mean.
Yeah.
And June. And
yeah.
And it just, for me, crosses the line because he has more to do with why Mean and June are in the situation they're in than anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to try and use the position they're in now against them makes me furious.
Yeah.
Let's just put it that way.
There was definitely a line that was crossed in this book that I don't necessarily think was crossed in the last one. Like the lines were crossed in the last one. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah.
There, another one was drawn and therefore crossed in this one. And it's just like, at this point, I have no sympathy for Captain Juan. And that's just how it is. I think you were smart to kind of steer away from some spoilery stuff there. So I'm not going to mention everything that I was going to mention for this next character, but I do want to talk about Sena, the shaman, and her Sapsali, which is a dog-like creature named Shield. And basically, Sena is a shaman who has various magical abilities. We've heard about them throughout this book, and we learn a little bit more about them here, but they can do a lot of different things. And I will be actually very interested if there are books going forward, if we'll see a little bit more of the shaman, because I think they're very interesting and their magic is different than some of, like, you know, the fox spirit, tiger spirit, dragon spirits that we've seen so far.
Well, and they've definitely set up to be very powerful individuals.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, shaman don't just have one set of skills. Like, they are responsible for a lot of magic, mm-hmm. and for very serious, crazy, intense magic too. So, like,
And they have their own governing body. Like, they kind of look after themselves. And I didn't get the sense that they were like, I kind of got the sense that they were almost neutral, leaning toward good, in that they definitely have their role in society and they definitely discourage shamans from going off the deep end. But at the same time, I think they're kind of looking out for themselves and their own interests. And that leans me a little bit more toward neutral. And I think that makes for an interesting story.
Oh, for sure. And to have an external sect of people that basically don't live by the rules of any other governing body, like, they police themselves, and the Thousand Worlds have decided to allow the shaman to police themselves. And you know what I mean? Like, it kind of gives off that feeling that, like, they take care of themselves and their own. And because we don't know how best to try and, you know, work with them, or, you know, we don't even want to mess with it, we're going to allow them to do their own thing. And so to have two groups like that coexist so peacefully, and for them to, you know, work together a lot, because we heard with the, you know, with the ghost planet and in Dragon Pearl, we heard about shaman, you know, and their possible work there, and the thing, you know, we heard mm-hmm. all about that. So the fact that they work pretty well together, you know, with humans and with other creatures, and it's not really a problem, it's just really remarkable and really cool.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think there's a story there somewhere, whether or not it brings us back to Mean and Mean dealing with the shamans or whatever. I would be interested to seeing them kind of come into the fold a little bit more. I think the really interesting thing about Sena was that she had a dog named Shield, and the dog's not really a dog. It's a Sapsali, like I said before. And the Sapsali has its own magical abilities, particularly ones that affect Mean. And that's, you know, we'll stop there. I thought that was a really interesting twist to the story. But the one thing I wanted to say about Shield is that if you go to the Reed Riordan entry for Sena and Shield, Shield is like a terrier looking dog. I don't remember if in the story it was described as looking like a terrier. I pictured him like an insane looking chihuahua. Specifically, my great aunt had a blind, literally neurotic chihuahua that was with no teeth, that was like absolutely insane. This dog did not look like it should be living. It looked like a zombie crazy thing. And that's how I pictured Shield the entire time. Like bug eyes going in two different directions, like cartoon character looking chihuahua. And then I went over to look at the entry, and it's this very regal kind of looking white terrier. I was like, sorry, I'm keeping the chihuahua in my head.
Okay, I definitely didn't picture a terrier, but mine wasn't a chihuahua either.
Okay.
I pictured a golden retriever.
Really?
No idea why. Until you said this just now, my brain was like, wait, what? Like, what? For some reason, I got golden retriever energy from this book.
That is so fun. Okay. I have to know if anybody else pictured Shield as a different breed of dog, because this is fascinating to me.
Like, maybe I just assume that golden retrievers taste like cloyingly sweet strawberry shampoo.
I mean, maybe.
Because that whole description, by the way, cracked me up.
That is so funny.
But yeah, golden retriever all the way. I never even thought twice about it. Like, from the moment Shield arrived on scene.
Yeah. Mine was instantly a chihuahua. That is so interesting.
Did we get a description? Now I'm curious. Yeah. Now
right.
Really,
if there's an actual description of Shield in the book, I don't know. Sometimes your head just goes in one direction. And even if it goes against the canon of the book, you're like, I don't know. This is what's in my head. It just exists that way. Sorry. Like Captain Juan with the tiger head for me. Like, it's just how I pictured him. I can't help it.
It's just a thing that happens and I can't do anything about it. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So before we venture into any actual spoiler territory, I think we're going to call our discussion of Tiger Honor there. I guess, you know, do you have any other thoughts on the book, and would you be interested in reading another book in this series, or do you feel like this story is good where it ended?
I definitely think there's room for more, especially because while I like that we got to see more from Mean and June, like, I don't necessarily think we got the closure for them that I really want. And I think Sabine has a lot still to do, and I'd love to see where Sabine ends up in the future. And I'm trying to think of all the other characters too. I'm like, who else is there? And like all of the friends we met in the short story, what was it? The
initiation. Yeah.
The initiation. Yeah. I was going to say the intervention, but I knew that was wrong. Yeah. Like, and all the friends we met in the initiation, like they all had really promising skill sets. And like, I would love to see Mean, you know, on a ship, whether it's this ship or another one in the future, with June still in tow, working alongside all of her friends. Like, that would be ideal for me, whether it was Mean's story again or someone else's. I don't necessarily care, but like, I would love to see that kind of take shape again. That would be really cool.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that there's also something going on with the Juwon clan, and I feel like there could definitely be another story there. Maybe not from another tiger's point of view, but somebody else's point of view, where they run into the Juwon clan. and we kind of figure out what's going on there. I think it would be really interesting to, because the cool thing about the Thousand Worlds series and the way that Yoon Ha-Lee has set it up so far is that the next book can be from somebody else's point of view, and we can get a completely new character in a completely new situation with completely different abilities, and it's still part of the story. And then we can have Min and Sabine and June along for the ride, kind of as secondary or tertiary characters, depending on what the story demands. And we can still move this like overarching plot along. And whether that's we look at the shamans next, or we look at the Tiger Clan next, or we follow a dragon spirit or a celestial or something like that, a goblin, like it kind of doesn't matter as long as we continue what started in Dragon Pearl in some way. So I would definitely read more. I think there's room for more. This is also a series where I think it's because we waited 3 years between books. I'm like, okay, if you want to write another one in 3 years, like I can wait that long because this book feels finished. And yet there's still a stepping off point to something else.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Like it's not something that needs to be constant. Like if Yoon comes back to this world and tells a story every couple of years or gets a really great idea and puts a couple of books together and then doesn't touch it again for 5 years or something. Like I feel like you can do that with the way they've set up this series.
Yeah. Completely agree. Really cool. Cool. Well, if you guys have read Tiger Honor, let us know what you thought of it. I'm very interested in hearing everybody's opinion. And let us know if you like us going through the books like this, if you like the reviews. And obviously, as always, if you have any other suggestions for us, let us know. But right now, I'm very excited to get back into Sea of Monsters. I've been super enjoying rereading this book. So you want to kick us off with chapter 9?
Sure. Okay, chapter 9 is entitled, I Have the Worst Family Reunion Ever. Before long, Percy, Annabeth, and Tyson are found by Luke right outside the grand stateroom of the ship. While it's beautifully designed and crafted, the huge gold terrifying sarcophagus leaves a lot to be desired. Luke tries to convince Percy and Annabeth to come over to his side, but no dice. So he settles for feeding them to the Ethiopian Drakon, but he only sends one of the bear twins with them, so Tyson easily overpowers him, and the three escape, or plummet to the water's surface in a free-falling lifeboat. Same thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, so, definitely yeah. The same thing.
Same thing. Escape, almost die. Yeah, same thing. All right. So yeah, one of the things we learned in this chapter is that not only can Tyson listen through walls, but he can mimic the voices inside.
Yeah, that's pretty creepy. I'm not going to lie. See, it's disconcerting.
All I could think of was, wow, that's handy. Like, it didn't come off as creepy to me. It just came off as like, oh, wow, that's really cool. Like, he can hear that well. I don't know. Maybe it's the Vampire Diaries fan in me that I've been dealing with creatures listening to other people for so long. Freaked me out, but
that's yeah. Gotta be so awkward too, is like being able to hear everything like that. But I think the only thing that makes it creepy for me is that Tyson, in my head, Tyson is this big hulking dude, right? And him mimicking other people's voices, especially, you know, if you're talking about like female voices and stuff like that, literally being able to mimic them and sound just like them, like that voice coming out of his mouth would just really throw me off. And I think yeah. He would get used to it. And obviously there's nothing sinister about Tyson at all, but like, right. I was slightly on Annabeth's side here where she was like, stop doing that. And I was like, yeah, it would probably make me feel a little uncomfortable too.
Meanwhile, I was Percy going, shh, Annabeth, keep going. What's going on? What are they talking about? And then, you know, before he can find out what they're talking about, he realizes that they're talking about how the people they want right outside the room. So they get escorted into the stateroom where Luke tells them, you know, about maybe half of his evil plan. I'd say roughly half. He didn't download the entire idea, but he gave him a good overview of what he's planning on doing here. And I think one of the things he says that struck me the most is he thinks Talia would be on his side.
Yeah.
And I don't know, man. And in the next chapter, we get Annabeth's reasoning for why not.
Mm-hmm.
But in this chapter, when I just, you know, when you think about it for a minute, like, we know that Talia had her issues with her father. But I feel like it takes something special to be on Cronus's side.
Yeah. So here's my thing about that. I totally see Luke's side in all of this. I understand why he hates the gods. I understand that he wants things to change because he's not happy. And I don't think there's anything inherently evil about any of that. And to that end, I feel like Talia would be on his side. I feel like most of the demigods would be on his side because a lot of them have had issues with their parents not claiming them or claiming them late or not showing up and not really being a parent. And so this running theme of the gods being absent parents makes sense to me why all of these kids will be so angry. I think, you know, if we're talking about crossing lines, I think where Luke goes wrong in all of this is literally hunting down and killing demigods who disagree with him. Backbiter has the ability to kill mortals.
Yeah,
that is not okay. And nope. I think that a large part of that, maybe we could say all of that is Cronus's influence, but at the same time, like, not 100% sure. Like, he is very bitter about this whole situation. And I think when you take that aspect into consideration, I really don't think Talia would be on his side. I don't think Talia would hunt down her fellow demigods. I don't think that she would want to hurt mortals or anything like that. But it's very difficult with the hindsight of the series in mind, because while I don't necessarily like Luke, ultimately what he's saying is an issue that has to be addressed.
And you're 100% right. Like, I do think that the things that started his anger with the gods that Cronus then fed on to get him to do the things he wants, it's the stuff that started Luke down that path that's completely reasonable. Like, the being upset at parents for not claiming their kids, you know, all of that stuff. It makes total sense. And I do agree with you that probably every demigod would be on his side if he was doing things in a reasonable way. But he's not.
Like, write a letter, man. Or, like, get an audience with Zeus. Or, like, march on Mount Olympus or something. Don't kill people.
Or tell them no more burnt offerings.
Right? Like, you get no food until you listen to us.
Like, stage a sit-in. Yeah. Eat all your meals on the lawn or something until...
Sit around the fire and eat it next to the fire, but don't actually put it in.
Right? So the fumes, like, get into the... Yeah.
Passive-aggressive eating.
Right? Yeah. No, I feel like there are better ways that he could have maybe tried to get his point across rather than allowing Cronus to take over his mind and convince him to do all of these crazy, crazy things. So, yeah, I don't think Talia would be on his side right now. If she were here in person, she would not be on his side, because you're right. Like, he's killing half-bloods. He's doing terrible things. He has a sword that can kill mortals. And I don't think Talia would be down for any of that.
He also poisoned her tree.
Right, which also, not cool. Yeah. Not cool.
Come on, but, man. Like,
I mean, she may have been Luke's friend, but she was also Annabeth's friend. And yeah. Annabeth, you know, I feel like Annabeth and Talia you know, whether or not Talia agrees more with Annabeth's thoughts on this or Luke's, like, I still don't think there's any way she would have ended up on Luke's side at this point.
Yeah.
But something to consider, definitely something to keep in mind. He also mentions in his little speech download thing that he still has friends at Camp Half-Blood.
Yeah.
Because he was more than willing to share with Percy the things he knew about Percy's time at Camp Half-Blood, mm-hmm. including the very specific coordinates of a thing that they possibly both want.
Yeah.
Which is very unfortunate.
I forgot that, you know, a lot of the details of this book, it's been so long since I've read it, I forgot them. And I was like, oh, wow, he knows the coordinates. Like, that's kind of a big deal. It's kind of nice because in a way you experience the book again for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, like, that's kind of a good twist in a story, is that the bad guy already knows where you're going. Okay, what does that mean? And like, how is that going to affect their quest? You know, and I don't remember who his friends are at camp. Is it Tantalus? Is it somebody else? Is it one of the other demigods? I don't remember.
Right. I don't either. I was kind of racking my brain trying to remember. And I'm like, I wouldn't think it would be anybody in Ares' cabin. Like, despite him being in Hermes and kind of being friends with everyone, like, I don't think it would have been an Ares person.
Mm-hmm.
Especially considering what Clarice is up to, we'll find out in the next book in the next chapter. You know, but like, especially considering what Clarice is up to, I don't think it'd be an Ares person. And it's, you know, I guess it could be somebody that's in Hermes' cabin that he bonded with when they were younger or something. I don't know, but
yeah,
it's definitely something to keep an ear open for if we end up back at Camp Half-Blood or if we hear things about Camp Half-Blood.
Mm-hmm.
There's somebody there telling tales.
Tantalus came from Tartarus. So his connection to Kronos is pretty close. So I wouldn't be surprised if he was feeding him information.
Which is a definite possibility.
Right.
That's definitely true. Yep. And the last thing from Luke's little diatribe is how pissed he gets when Percy mentions Hermes.
Yeah. Really angry.
Like, he loses his mind.
Mm-hmm.
He's just like, don't mention his name. Like,
I feel like that's really interesting too, because it's not like I don't think Luke has a reason to hate his father. However, we met Hermes, and Hermes was friendly. Hermes obviously cared about Luke, and Hermes was willing to forgive him. And so you kind of wonder how much Luke has blown this out of proportion. Now, I think that Hermes and the other gods are definitely at fault. They are absent parents. But Hermes is a god. He doesn't have to concern himself with the life of one child, even if that child is throwing a temper tantrum. And I think it speaks to Hermes's character that he is getting involved and that he wants Luke to talk to him so that they can figure this out. But Luke doesn't want any part of that. And that to me is really telling in a way of maybe how Luke has been sitting on this anger for so long that it's warped into something that Kronos can further manipulate.
Yeah. And to be honest, I think Luke's biggest bone to pick is with every other god, like anyone but his father, because his father, despite not being perfect, I mean, Hermes could definitely do better, but at least Hermes likes to find a home and find room for everyone.
Right.
Like, at least the idea of Hermes is welcoming, and Hermes doesn't seem shy about claiming his children. Like, most of the Hermes cabin that's been claimed, you know, like, there's tons of actual Hermes children in the Hermes cabin. There's also mm-hmm. a ton of unclaimed children in there, which I can understand Luke being really perturbed that the other gods aren't claiming their children and that he's having to take care of and worry about all of these young children that shouldn't be his responsibility.
Yeah.
I can see that being a sticking point, but then in that case, like, his real fight is with all the other gods. It's not with Hermes.
Right. By the way, I think the phrase unclaimed children is really funny because, like, I just imagine, like, children sitting in, like, a little warehouse, like, waiting to be claimed.
Well, see, I'm seeing them on the baggage claim rack going around and around.
That's even better.
At the airport. And they're just waiting. Gosh.
The children claim goes in circles and circles, and then somebody takes them off and puts them on a little cart and, like, shuffles them over to the wall and stacks them in a line.
After a while, they just get shoved into long-term storage. AKA the Hermes cabin.
Children's storage.
I think we've made it clear that Luke isn't without point here. Mm-hmm. He'd have some legitimate gripes, and, you know, later on in the series we know that Percy addresses some of those as well, but it's, you know, he's taken it to an extreme and it's time for him to stop. Done. Easy peasy. If only it was that easy. Okay, so yeah, this chapter ends with the trio escaping, thank goodness, basically thanks to Luke's idiocy. Or was it kind of planned?
Or intentional? That's what we're still trying to figure out.
Yeah, did he want them to escape? Because he puts them in the hands of the dumber of his two cronies.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a point to say that Tyson was easily overpowered by both of them. But, like, obviously Tyson's a very strong guy. And, yeah. So Tyson easily overpowers the one, slaps him into the pool, which...
That was pretty funny.
Yeah, correct me up, by the way. And then, they escape on a lifeboat. It's a little harrowing at the start, but we'll see how it ends in a moment. So, okay. Let's do favorite quotes. Karen, do you want to go first?
Yeah, this was near the beginning of the chapter when the three of them are grabbing their bags and Percy is kind of narrating and says, "We figured whatever happened, we would not be staying another night aboard the zombie cruise ship, even if they did have $1 million bingo."
I still can't believe they were able to sleep an entire night without being found.
I know. Pretty lucky.
Like, it's kind of insane. I guess maybe it's just a really big cruise ship, but it made me laugh because I was like, wow, they did get a good night's sleep, didn't they?
And 90% of the people are zombies, so.
This is true. Okay, my favorite quote was, "Your mother was born from Zeus's split skull, Annabeth. I wouldn't talk." I don't know why, but there's just something about the way Luke said this.
Yeah.
When he was talking about Cronus, like, bringing Cronus back and, like, you know, pulling bits of him from Tartarus slowly but surely. And Annabeth's like, "That's gross." And he's like, "Your mother was born from Zeus's split skull." And I'm like, okay, burn. Like, he earned that one. So yeah, that was definitely one of my favorites. What was your favorite moment?
My favorite moment was when Tyson wants to beat up Luke because he was mean to Percy. Because Tyson is just hard on his sleeve, love for Percy immediately, and I can't blame him for that. And it just endears me to him every time I read about him.
Yeah, he's kind of a cinnamon roll.
He is totally a cinnamon roll.
He's a cinnamon roll who packs a wallop, we'll put it that way.
Yeah.
Tyson is the MVP of this episode because my favorite moment is Tyson walloping Aureus into the pool and the zombie kids going off script and yelling, "We are not having fun in the pool," and, like, getting out.
I almost picked this moment because them going off script, I was laughing so hard. It was so funny.
Like, that, just that "we are not having fun in the pool" cracked me up so much. I loved it. Okay, so let's move on to chapter 10, entitled, "We Hitch a Ride with Dead Confederates." "Thanks for the wind, Hermes." Percy puts the first gift from Hermes to good use, to ease their plummet to the sea and to propel them across the sound after. They try to iris message Chiron, but the discotheque he's currently grooving in makes it hard for either party to understand him. They make their way to one of Annabeth, Luke, and Talia's old hideouts, only to stumble across a Monster Donuts and a Hydra moments later. Thank goodness Clarice was there to come to their aid. That's right. You read that correctly. Yes, first of all, how lucky were they that one of Hermes' gifts was a thermos full of wind?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you're a god, like, you kind of... It's not like they know what's coming necessarily, but they do have this like foresight kind of thing going on. And I think he knew that it was going to be necessary being out on the open ocean, because he sent them onto the ship knowing what the ship was.
Right.
So no, he probably knew they had to get a quick getaway, and it was very lucky that he had that thermos full of wind.
Yes, yes. It did occur to me that Percy, maybe Percy with a little more experience controlling the water, could have maybe like summoned a big wave to sweep them up and stop their progress so that they wouldn't have to fall quite that far.
Yeah.
But again, he hasn't spent that much time like practicing his wave summoning and all that. So like, I don't know if it would have worked out quite the way we wanted it to.
Right. Yeah. I think book five, Percy might be able to handle that, but book two, Percy's still got he's still trying to get his sea legs a little bit.
Yeah. So thank goodness Hermes thought ahead and gave him a very useful tool. Because not only does it get him out of that sticky situation, but it keeps them moving across the sound, because otherwise they would have been in a lifeboat and either Percy or Annabeth would have been paddling.
Right.
And it would have taken a very long time.
So long.
Yeah. So the wind allows them to speedboat right across the sound and get where they need to go pretty quickly.
Yeah. I liked the iris message part. One, because we know who Chiron is with. And I am very excited to come up on that again eventually. So that's pretty cool. But that aside, I had some questions about iris messaging, because apparently I just wanted to think about this way more deeply than probably the book demanded. But okay. So we know that to send an iris message, you typically need to create a rainbow. Okay. And to create a rainbow, usually you have like spray of water. We saw in the last book, they use like a hose at the car wash. It created a rainbow. They throw a gold drachma in. You ask Iris to send your message to somebody and she tries to deliver it for you. Now, this time with them going across the ocean the way they were, it kicked up enough water that it created a rainbow. They were able to contact Chiron. Now, do we know? I did try looking this up on like the wiki pages and stuff, and I didn't come to a concrete answer. Do we know how the iris messages appear to the other side? Like, does it show up in nearby water? Like if you're near, you know, a fountain or something, does the iris message like pop out of that? What if you're not around water? And I don't necessarily think that's the case, but that was where my mind went immediately. Or does a rainbow like magically appear in front of you? And when it does that, like, do you get wet because like of the spray or something? I don't know why I care so much about this, but I just want to know.
Well, okay. My brain, especially because they could kind of see and hear what was happening behind Chiron.
Yeah.
In this scene, It makes me think that you're basically opening a window. So because Annabeth and Percy have the rainbow and they insert the drachma and open the window, it opens for Chiron. So yes, I think he could see where they were. And I think he probably could feel the spray. It's probably not like drenching, but like I can imagine him like feeling a bit of that sea spray from the boat's propeller, you know, from the wind.
Yeah. So I'm curious, like, what else could travel through the window? Cause like, I don't think they can like physically give them stuff.
No, I just kind of assumed that like, it's like opening, not necessarily opening a window, but it's creating a window. so that you can see between the two and like have a communication of some sort.
Yeah.
Not an open window where you could like hand things through. You're right. But like a window where you can communicate between.
Yeah. I just want to know if every time you answer an Iris message, do you have to like go get a change of clothes or like a towel to like dry off?
I mean, unless they're using like a waterfall.
Maybe not.
I hope not.
Yeah.
But maybe. We'll have to keep an eye out for somebody receiving an Iris message because I know Percy receives Iris messages in the future. We'll have to see like how it goes and how it works because, yeah, that's definitely something I'm interested to learn more about too. So I'm with you there. Percy, in their trip across the Sound after they've sent their Iris message, Annabeth kind of stumbles on to a hidden talent of Percy's.
Yeah.
And it certainly seems like she's excited about her new toy.
I'm also excited. Like, perfect bearings at sea. I would not be worried if I was on a boat with Percy. Like, you'd never be lost at sea. That's awesome. Nope.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Oh my gosh. Like, imagine if Anna from Daughter of the Deep and those two got together aboard the Nautilus. Percy would know where they are at any given time.
Oh, that would be so cool.
Yeah.
She Crossover. Would be so jealous.
Yeah, she would be.
Like, she owns the Nautilus, and she would still be jealous of Percy.
Yeah.
You have perfect bearings? You monster. Like, you know what I mean? Like, she would be so mad. That would be great. It would be so great. Anyway. Okay, so then after Percy's hidden talent, they need to get off the water because the Coast Guard's on their tail. And Annabeth says she knows where to hide, and they find a place in the cove. She has them pull up onto the bank, and they hide the boat. And then she ushers them into a little 3-person hut full of not only, like, human supplies, but also half-blood demigod supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And we quickly learn that apparently her, Luke, and Talia had built a whole bunch of these, probably, I would guess, all over the East Coast.
Yeah, when they were on the run.
And it just so happened that they were close enough to be able to use this one today to hide from the Coast Guard. And that gets us to the Monster Donuts, because, you know, Percy sends Tyson out into the wilderness and says, you know, keep an eye out for donuts or whatever. And
I think he was trying to get rid of them so he could talk to Annabeth, but
I think so too. So while they're in the hut, her and Percy have a discussion, and it's basically Percy trying to get out of Annabeth what Talia would feel, since Luke was so insistent that Talia would be on his side. Percy was trying to, you know, get something out of Annabeth. And she pretty definitively says, like, Talia would not be on his side. She had her issues with her godly parents, yes. But then she says that Talia and Percy, like, would either be the best of friends or they'd kill each other.
Yeah. I actually really loved this part because I liked that Annabeth was basically like, you guys are very similar. And I loved that Percy was like, I hope we would be best friends, maybe because the other option was killing each other. But it's so interesting when you become friends with somebody and then you start to incorporate their circle into yours because you worry about those sort of things and you worry how you're going to mesh. And especially with somebody who's gone. And I mean, for all intents and purposes, like, Talia's dead, quote unquote. And yet her memory and legacy lives on, and Percy kind of has to wonder what it would have been like for them to be together. And I really loved that the idea of, maybe it's a little bit too, because it's a boy and a girl, and it's like, oh, like, I hope we could be best friends. Like, I love those kind of stories, like those platonic relationships that no matter how dissimilar you are in terms of your experiences, you can still be friends. And then them being part of the big three, children of the big three, and kind of having that weight on their shoulders also makes them very similar at the same time. And it's just, it's something cool to think about in this moment where we don't even have an inkling that Talia exists or will ever exist within this story.
Right. Yes. I mean, in this point in the series, we have no idea that we could at any point meet Talia. So this is all just us getting an idea of what Annabeth's thoughts on her friend would be and all of that. But yeah, it's still a good moment, I think, and a really sweet moment between the two of them before Tyson
ruins it.
Before Tyson comes barging in with donuts.
Yeah.
I've got donuts.
I really liked this justification that franchises are like evil, basically, and franchise chain stores feed off the life force of monsters.
That they're like, monster nests.
Yeah, that is so funny to me. But like, I get it, you know, because chains are the worst.
It is. And I love when they're fighting the Hydra, we'll get there. Annabeth goes, Percy, you just made another monster donut.
And he's like, why does that matter right now?
Yeah, like, it's really, really well done. And yeah, I love it. I love it so much. Monster Donuts has sprung up in the middle of nowhere. And I love that Percy tries to justify the Monster Donuts thing. He's like, there's a ton of them. They can't be evil. And then she explains to him what, you know, the whole chain thing is. But I love that he takes a moment to be like, they can't be evil. They're everywhere. See, it's fine. And she's like, we're in the middle of the wilderness, Percy. There's not supposed to be a building here. Like, come on. So I love that. Love it. Love it. But we quickly they quickly come across a Hydra who sneaks up behind them and decides to make their life a living hell. Now, I got really confused for a moment. Did you too?
Yes, I got confused. So I was like, they already met the Hydra. Why is Percy surprised? And then I was like, oh yeah, that was the movie. But I will say, book Percy is smarter than movie Percy because he only cuts off one head before he realizes it's a bad idea.
Yeah. For some reason, my brain was like, the movie. Oh crap. Okay. First book. That was a chimera. Yes. Not a Hydra. Okay. Yeah. So if you were a little confused, it's probably because you watched the movie with us. I'm very sorry.
Yeah. We apologize for the inconvenience.
But yet another reason why they should have saved the Hydra for the future.
Right. So, I mean, why would you look? We already talked about it. We don't need to. Why would you switch them?
We already debated this, but yes. Just another reason, another good point. But this Hydra is not easy to defeat, and it's looking really bad for Annabeth and Percy, and Tyson's doing what he can, but, you know, he can only be so much help. When, out of nowhere, Clarice saves the day.
Yeah. I liked this. I liked that Clarice showed up and saved them. I liked that she didn't hesitate, but she also had to, like, hold it over their heads for a minute too.
What did she say? I think she said, damn the heroes.
Yeah.
One of her Confederate dudes was like, they're too close. And she goes, damn the heroes. And she loads the cannon anyway. So they're just like, okay, here we go. And that's when Annabeth's like, hit the deck.
And I think she says like something about like, guess I had to save you losers or something like that.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It was funny.
Classic Clarice for sure. Classic Clarice. But yeah, so Clarice saves the day and kills the Hydra. Thank goodness. And that is where this chapter ends. So let's start with favorite quotes. Mine is, but whenever Annabeth talked about the time she'd spent with them, I kind of felt, I don't know, uncomfortable? No, that's not the word. The word was jealous. This is in Percy's head when he's thinking about her talking about like all of her time with Luke and Talia. Mm-hmm. And I just love that at, you know, he's what, 13? Is he 13 in this book?
Did he have his birthday? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, like I think a full year has passed since last book, so I think he's 13. But like, for a 13-year-old to be able to admit that he's jealous of her friends,
to recognize that,
right? To like, just to be able to say, like, yeah, I'm really jealous of them. Like, I wish I could have been there with them. It's not like he, you know, is jealous that she ever had friends before him, but you can tell he's jealous she had adventures before him, and he wants to be a part of all of her stories. And, you know, it's just really cute. And so that bit stuck out at me.
Yeah, I think it's very telling that he's getting closer to Annabeth because he has this jealousy now. And like, if he just thought of her as another demigod, even like kind of a friend, he probably wouldn't feel this way about her. But they're becoming best friends. Like, before any romantic stuff actually gets involved here, like, they're becoming best friends. And I think it's very normal for him to be like, like, I want her attention. That makes a lot of sense to me, especially a couple of kids who have gone through such intense things together to feel that way. And I like that he admitted it to himself.
Yeah. And I don't necessarily think it's like a possessive jealousy either. It's I'm jealous that she did all this stuff before me. Like, I wish I could have been there too. Like, I wish, you know, and that's, it's really sweet and just makes me love Percy all the more.
Yeah.
But what was yours?
Mine was also another Percy narration, and he says, "Vine-covered trees loomed above us. Insects chirred in the woods. The air was muggy and hot, and steam curled off the river. Basically, it wasn't Manhattan, and I didn't like it." I feel like this is such a true statement for people like born and raised in New York City. Is like, anything outside the city is like, oh my God. Where are we? What are we doing? This is insane. Let's just go back to the city. And I just love that he had that attitude. It was so funny. But also, it is a long way from Manhattan.
I mean, it is. It's definitely true. They're in the wilderness, basically. So, you know, it's a bit of a departure. Okay, and then favorite moments. Mine is when Percy tries to reason that monster donuts are all over Manhattan and there's no reason to worry.
Yeah.
it's just hilarious.
We apparently loved the donuts, because my favorite moment was when Tyson actually does come back with donuts, because I laughed. It was so funny.
It's all about the donuts, man. All
yeah. Donuts. Now I want to know if there's like monster donut logos out there, like, or stuff like that. That could be really cool to own.
Yeah, that's a distinct possibility there, I would say. We'll have to check that out. Or if anyone finds one, we'll go check it out, because that sounds like fun.
Yeah, link us. I'll probably buy one. I need some Percy stickers in my life.
There you go. Okay, so that wraps up our discussion for this week. Next week, we will be talking about chapters 11 and 12, so make sure to give those a read. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at subjectifymedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which was recently revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast, or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. Please find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms, and consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help other people find us and help us to rank, so we would really, really appreciate that. Please leave us questions and comments in any of those places, or ideas for content you might want to see, and we'll keep a lookout. Next week, in addition to our chapters of Sea of Monsters, we'll also be talking about The Diary of Luke Castellan from the Demigod Diaries, which is one of the short stories we talked about a couple weeks ago on that episode with all the extraneous materials, when we talked about the coloring books and all of the other guides. So
yeah,
it's available in the Demigod Diaries, but it should be fun.
And if you don't own that, remember to look at your local library. You should be able to pick it up. No problem.
Yep, yep, yep. Okay. So this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.